So yesterday we introduced the state operator map, and we said it's a general property of CFTs, and we looked at some concrete examples in the, for the scalar fields, and we learned how to build vertex operators, which are a way to create, which are operators dual to momentum states for the free scalar. Perhaps it's worth to say a couple more words about the state operator map in general. I'm gonna just write a couple formulas which I'm not gonna really use over the lectures, but you've probably seen them already in the conformal field theory when you studied conformal field theory. So just worth mentioning them as a matter of language mostly. So we've encountered operators we transformed in a sort of specific way under coordinate transformations. For example, we saw that the derivative of x transforms like that with the Jacobian under a change of coordinates. We saw that the vertex operators transform with a very interesting power of the Jacobian due to the renormalization of the operator. And so these are more, these are specific examples of a general rule. There are some operators called primary operators, which have the property that they transform with powers to the Jacobian. So in this case, the conformal dimension, so these, in these numbers, delta and delta bar, are called conformal dimensions. There is an holomorphic and an anthropomorphic one. So for example, dx has conformal dimension, holomorphic conformal dimension 1, and anthropomorphic 1, 0. While the vertex operator has delta equal to delta bar, equal to pi squared over 2. Now, the sum of delta and delta bar is also called the scaling dimension. It tells you how the operator behaves under a scaling transformation. And delta minus delta bar is just the spin of the operator. Now, not all operators transform like this. For example, if you take a second derivative, a third derivative of x, they'll have a more complicated transformation which involves derivatives of the Jacobian. The ones that transform like these are called primary operators. Now, conformal transformations are implemented by the modes of the stress tensor. So when you do the state operator map, these operators map to states with specific properties under the action of the Virasoro modes. Delta and delta bar control the eigenvalues of L0 and L0 bar. And the other modes of the stress tensor with positive index annihilate these states. So if you remember, these are the conditions of being highest weight state. So highest weight maps to primary, which is the reason I kept calling these states primaries in that lecture. So, and you see that these statements are true for this example, right? The first example mapped to A minus 1 acting on the vacuum, for example. is this a primary? Well, if I activate L2, L3, L4, and so on, they annihilate for sure. L1 is the only one who's dangerous, but L1 contains inside A1 multiplied by A0. So if this is 0, L1 annihilates this. And then L0 on this gives you 1, as it should. On the other hand, this map to the ground states. These are also highest weights. Now, there are a variety of operators that can transform in other ways. Some of them are important. The most important is the stress tensor. The stress tensor almost behaves like a two-index tensor, like almost transformed with something involving the square of the Jacobian, except for a correction. Is a function of the coordinate transformation. I think this is 0, 12. Anyway, the correction is proportional to the central charge. In particular, when you go from the plane to the cylinder, you find something like this. This is the reason we included a 0 over 24 in the definition of L0, if you remember. I was writing the TS, the sum of e to the minus ns ln minus 0 over 24. I put the 0 over 24 here precisely because it's conventional to define the modes of operators in the plane rather than the cylinder. OK. Now we are pretty much ready to discuss the state operator map for the ghosts. How do ghosts transform under coordinate transformations? Well, the big ghost transforms as a two-index object, has no extra anomaly. So, for example, we have BZ is e to the minus 2s BS B of s, and you go from the cylinder to the plane. The C ghost transform it as an object with one up index. You get a formula like that. So B has dimension 2, C has dimension minus 1. Now, negative dimensions never occur in unitary theories, but they can happen to ghosts because the ghosts are not unitary. Why do I say that negative dimensions never occur in unitary theories? Because of the simple calculation. In the unitary theory, this is positive because the norm of a state. But this is also equal to this. So in the unitary theory, of all dimensions are positive. They only vanish if something is annihilated by, if your primary is annihilated by L minus 1. So for unitary theory, now it turns out that the state operator map sends this state to a very specific operator, to the derivative of the operator associated to this. So essentially, this is telling you that the derivative of the operator vanishes, which essentially means that the operator is the identity. Unitary theory, there is a unique operator with scaling dimension zero, which is the identity. In non-unitary theories, you can have many more things happen. For example, we saw that the ground state had energy minus one, so had negative H for ghosts. Now, using these relations and starting from this equation, we can derive the, we can try to map to the plane. So if I multiply this by the appropriate powers of e to the s into the minus s and change coordinates, I will go to 1 over z minus z prime. This happens to be the correlation function on the plane of c and b. So why is that? Remember that the action of the ghosts is B del bar C. So the two-point function on the plane should be the Green's function for this action. Should be something whose del bar is the delta function. And this is indeed the case. So
we actually worked that out in the two-point correlation function. But Gudrun has a question that
it's not the expectation between the same two. We asked him earlier.
I think I might answer the question yesterday after class. So these two turn out to be equal, which confirms the idea that, which explains why I introduced this state zero at all. I introduce this state zero because it happens to be the one that maps to nothing under state operator map. So the first item in the dictionary for ghosts is that the identity operator is mapped to the vacuum state, not to the ground state. Why? Well, this has dimension zero, and it also happens to be annihilated by n minus one. It's not something you can see immediately. You know, you need to write down the stress tensor for the ghost with this b del c plus 2 del c, del b. No, the other way around. Anyway, you need to write the stress tensor, expand it in mode, and see what does it do. But once we have one piece of the dictionary, we can produce other pieces. Not only this has conformal dimension zero. If you remember, also this had charge minus 3/2. Now, this might worry you because you could say, OK, wait, the identity operator definitely has charge zero. But the point is that the ghost current is anomalous. So there is an anomaly in the transformation of when you do coordinate transformations to the ghost current. You can find this anomaly just going back to the definition as point splitting. Now, I might have written down the anomalous transformation or not. It was probably in the slides in the lectures for two lectures ago. So if I write it down, I would probably write the wrong formula. But roughly, you get an extra. So naively, the transformation rule would be something like this. A current, but there is an extra term that is a 3/2, and then some function. I don't remember what it exactly is, if it's a second derivative. I don't want to mess it up, but there is something built out of S and S prime that you can find by looking at the point splitting regularization of the current. So when you go from the plane to this, from the cylinder to the plane, this extra term gives you precisely 3/2 that cancels this. So this state is in the correct Gauss number, has a correct conformal dimension, and is annihilated by the derivative operator. And so we recognize that it's dead entity, or we just do the calculation. We do a correlation function on the cylinder with any number of B's and C's. We get some weak, some answer given by weak contractions based on this. And so it will have to match this answer based on weak contractions built from this. And now we keep going. For example, now we can look at a ground state. Oh, sorry. First, for example, I can do something like this. I can derive this statement just by starting from a correlation function like this and sending the C ghost to the origin, as we did yesterday, and so on and so forth. So the fact that there is a 1 here is pretty much related to the fact that C has dimension minus 1. The fact that there was a minus 2 here is related to the fact that B has dimension 2. The fact that there was a minus 1 over there comes from the fact that dx had dimension 1. But again, you can just check it by using the definition. So in particular, the ground state maps to CC bar. Because the ground state is obtained from a vacuum vacuum with C1 and C1 bar. OK. Now, the state operator map is not only good for defining, for doing calculations on the cylinder or the plane. It has a much broader application. So suppose that I have some surface. It is not necessarily the plane, OK? Something might be happening complicated far away. I don't care. But let's just focus on a patch of a surface with some operator insertion or at some point, which I call conventionally 0. Then this correlation function equals a correlation function on a different surface, which does exactly the same stuff far away, but goes in which this point has been replaced by an semi-infinite tube. So these surfaces are related just by a wild transformation, where the wild factor blows up the neighborhood of this point. Essentially, you want the wild factor to go like 1 over r squared as you approach the point. That will make this tube. Right. If the metric is behaving more or less as the r squared plus r squared, the phi squared, as you approach the origin, and I do a wild transformation, I can get the metric to behave as the r squared over r squared plus the phi squared. This is a flat cylinder in log r and phi coordinates as r approaches 0. For example, suppose I start from my cylinder, OK? We saw this. This is with the cylinder. We can go to the plane by doing ds, ds bar, e to the, what was e to the minus 2 tau. Sorry, I want it to become very small in the past and very big in the future, so I'm opening it up. So this seems maybe wrong sign, okay. And this became the plane. But there is something more fun I can do. I can do this. This is shrinking down and collapsing both ends of the cylinder. What happens if I collapse both ends smoothly? I end up with a sphere. Now, this might not be immediately recognizable as the metric on a sphere. But it is. For example, if I change coordinates precisely like that, I go to the z bar over 1 plus z squared squared, which is stereographic coordinates for the sphere. So in these coordinates, the north pole is z equal to 0, the south pole is z equal to infinity. Or if you prefer, you can do, let me see. Let's write that out in detail. We have d squared tau over e to the tau plus e to the minus tau squared plus d squared sigma over e to the tau plus e to the minus tau squared. Suppose I want to make this into something like d theta squared. I can write a coordinate where the property d theta is d tau over e to the tau plus e to the minus tau. Let me see. I used to be able to do this. This one over cosh. The integral is some log of something. I know the transformation should be sine theta equal, sine theta equal to e to the tau plus e to the minus tau. Let's try this. This means that cosine theta is e to the tau minus e to the minus tau over e to the tau plus e to the minus tau, just by doing square root of this 1 minus t squared. I probably want to put a here to make it work. Because when I square this and I do 1 minus this, I get the square of the denominator minus 4, which becomes the square of that. So taking the derivative, this means that d theta cosine theta is, minus 2 e to the tau minus e to the minus tau over d squared, which means the theta is indeed minus 2 over e to the tau plus e to the minus tau of the tau. Okay, so plugging it back here, I discovered that this is the theta squared plus sine squared theta the sigma squared, 1 over 4. And this you should recognize that it is the round sphere metric, right? The theta squared plus sine squared theta, the sigma squared is the sphere metric. So in particular, now I can put generic states both in the future and in the past and hope to convert them both to operators at the North Pole and the South Pole. Okay, so let me forget about the plane. When I said it, if I put a psi here and a psi tilde here, it should be the same as inserting. Sorry, maybe this was infinity and this was zero. And O of psi here, and then O of psi tilde there. So the two-point the inner product of states on the cylinder becomes the sort of two-point functions on the sphere of operators. And conform of field theory, this is actually a conventional way to define a two-point an inner product between operators. And conform of field theory, the inner product of operators is defined by putting one at the origin, one at the north pole, and the other at the south pole of a sphere. And by state operator map is the same as the inner product between the corresponding states. So when you work on the sphere, it's convenient to keep using these coordinates, the same ones as we are using for the plane. They cover almost all the sphere except the point at infinity. And then you can define a second coordinate which covers the other half, the other part of the sphere, which misses only the origin of z equal to 0. So correlation functions of operators on the sphere, if you don't have an operator at infinity, will be the same as correlation functions on the plane. Okay? Because we are using literally the same coordinate system. So I don't have to worry about any transformations of operators. If you want to put an operator at infinity, the easiest thing to do is to move it away from infinity a little bit, go to the plane, and then send it to infinity. But we actually will not need it at all. We can just happily avoid putting operators at infinity for our purposes. So let's try to do some calculations. I want in particular to do calculations for the ghosts. Notice that the sphere has curvature, so there will be a ghost number anomaly. The total ghost number anomaly will be 3 for the holomorphic side and 3 for the anthropomorphic side. In other words, I'll need 3 C's more than B's and 3 C bars more than B bars. But we already saw that, right? We saw that 0, C1, C1 bar, C0, C0 bar, C minus 1, C minus 1 bar, 0 is something that is non-zero. And as the name anticipated, this is the state which corresponds to inserting nothing on the sphere, inserting an identity on the sphere, and this is the state that corresponds to the identity. So this correlation function has precisely 3 C's and 3 C bars, which agrees with the ghost number anomaly. Now let's try to make a general correlation function. So suppose that I want to compute this, a correlation function on the sphere of C of Z1, C bar of Z1 bar, C of Z2, C bar of Z2 bar, C of Z3, C bar of Z3 bar. Notice I didn't really need to take this point to be the contour, so to take this point to coincide with this point. But why not? So what I'm calling Z1 bar here could have been a Z1 bar prime. Anyway, how do we compute this? Well, the idea we go to the cylinder, we do the calculation on the cylinder, for example. On the cylinder, we have a zero here, a zero here. And then we expand all of these into Fourier modes. But the only thing we pick is terms where I have a C1, a C1 bar, a C0, a C0 bar, a C-1, and a C1, minus 1 bar. Yes?
The indices there is like 1, 1, 2, 2, and 3, 3. It's a bit small. The indices is that Z1, Z1 bar, Z3.
Yes. That's right.
And the set 3 is a V1.
That's right. And so there are going to be a lot of terms, because this C1 could be coming from either of the three C's. This C0 could be coming from either of the three C's. This C minus 1 from either of the three C's. There are about 6 terms for the C's and 6 for the C bars. Or in the dust settles, the answer is pretty simple. OK. This is our first sphere calculation. Does it make sense? Well, for example, if I bring Z1 to Z2, I get a 0 because C is a fermion. If I just, now, here the thing is a little bit clouded by the fact that I put Z1 bar to be conjugate to Z1 and Z2 bar to be conjugate to Z2. But suppose that this is just an independent coordinate, OK? Then this thing has a factor that is Z1 minus Z2, which is anti-symmetric under exchange of Z1 and Z2, because these are fermions. So you could have guessed this answer just by requiring it to have the correct to be anti-symmetric and to agree with the scaling properties of C. OK. Yeah, for example, how many factors are there here? There are a total of 6 factors, right? And there are a total of 6 fields of dimension minus 1. And there are a total of 6 factors that are linear in coordinates. So this behaves well under scaling. We say well under translations. You can even check that it behaves well under this. And that pretty much fixes it. In general, in conformal field theories, three-point functions are fixed. The functional form of three-point functions is fixed in terms of the conformal dimensions of operators. So I could do a similar calculation for the Drake boson. Again, I could really just write down the answer using conformal symmetry, but otherwise we can do a calculation. How do we compute this? We do weak contractions. Okay. In principle, we expand this in power series, expand this in power series, and do all possible weak contractions and use some painful combinatorics. That's the way to do the calculation. Or I go back to the definition. This is the path integral with some extra source terms inserted as Z1, Z2, Z3. I just complete the squares and evaluate it. One way or another, the answer takes a very similar form to that, except that the powers change because the conformal dimensions change. There is a delta function of P1 plus P2 plus P3. So this conformal function is non-zero only if P1 plus P2 plus P3 vanishes. And really, I should put a delta function here. So why is that? It's because I have a compact space. The sphere is a compact space. So correlation functions will vanish unless the total charge is 0, unless there is an anomaly. Translations of the free scalar has no anomaly. These operators have charged P1, P2, P3 under translations of the scalar field. So you just see this. Suppose I take the correlation function and I redefine x by shifting it by 1. Okay? This whole thing transforms by e to the ip1 plus ip2 plus ip3. but it's the same correlation function. So it must be that P1 plus P2 plus P3 vanish. Okay, so these are the main three-point functions I need today. So we're finally ready to do string theory. So we have all, we have accumulated all the ingredients needed to compute scattering amplitudes in string theory. So the first simplest example is a situation where some string breaks into two. So how do I evaluate this? Let's say three tachyons for simplicity. Okay, so I'm putting here a state which is momentum P1 tensor the Gauss ground state. Here I'm going to put a state which is momentum P2 tensor ground state. And here momentum P3 tensor with the ground state. Yes?
So what are these states in the three-point function? Are they zero, delta, and zero, or just all zero?
Where?
On the up.
There are no states. It's a correlation function on the sphere. It's a compact space. I really don't need to specify anything there. Okay. I mean, you might have been worrying on the plane if I what state did I compute my correlation functions in. But here we are on the sphere. Okay. There are no boundary conditions, nothing to do with the path integral on a compact space-time.
We can use conformal symmetry to fix that function.
Sorry, maybe I didn't get the question then.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so can we use that conformal symmetry to fix the three-point function
that
what we did in
a
general
sense. Oh, yes, I'll get this is my next statement. So,
okay.
But just a moment. Okay, see, I can say now. So, I mentioned that this transforms well under translations and under inversion. In general, it transforms well under conformal transformations on the sphere. So, there is a set of diffeomorphisms for the sphere which map it back to a sphere up to wild transformations. Okay? These are transformations which send z to az plus b over cz plus d. Okay? You can get them just by doing a translation, an inversion, another translation, maybe another inversion. At the end, you get something like this. Because I can always rescale numerator and denominator by the same amount, these have 3 degrees of freedom. Okay? There are 3 complex degrees of freedom. I can use these 3 degrees of freedom to move around the points essentially wherever I want. So another way to get to these correlation functions is to send a point to some convenient values, say 0, 1, and infinity, for example, and then do a conformal transformation to put it wherever else I want.
The correlation function is calculated on the sphere. We can use conformal symmetry, but it is on the complex plane. We cannot do that.
Yes. So this correlation function can also be understood as a correlation function on the plane. Sorry, I misunderstood your initial question. I thought you had asked me if I needed to specify a state when discussing the correlation function on the sphere, and I said no. But it was not your question, so I'm sorry.
Okay. So I think my question is like, so what's the difference between R2 and S2? Like, why is it different in using the symmetry to calculate them?
It's not different. I could have used this symmetry also on R2.
Okay. But if we calculate on R2, the result will be different, right? Like CB 2-point correlation function, we will get 1 over Z minus W. So
you're concerned by the fact that in that correlation function, I didn't put three C's.
Yeah.
Two. But before you try to compare that and that, you need to figure out what happens when I do a wild transformation of the plane to go to the sphere. Now, as a, we can go to the cylinder as an intermediate step. Actually, we don't need to invoke the cylinder. So let's start from the plane. Before we go all the way to the sphere, let's perhaps go to something that looks like this. That's something that looks like a half cylinder cut off, okay? So infinity in the plane goes to infinity here and then goes to infinity here. Now, the statement is that infinity here for the ghosts goes to the state 0 tilde. But the state 0 tilde does not go to nothing here. It goes to C1, C1 bar. But I pragmatic is an operator. To C, del bar, del square C, C bar, del bar, C bar, del bar square, C bar square. So calculations on the plane might have an untrivial state here. And actually, which state do you find here when you do a calculation on the plane is not a universal statement. It kind of depends on what. For example, if I do a calculation on a free boson on the plane, strictly speaking, I can let some charge go to infinity. But then when I try to go on the sphere, I'll end up with a vertex operator there. So, what can I say? I'm sorry that. So if you have conformal field theory in your background, perhaps the statements I make on the plane are more confusing than useful. I could have just worked on the sphere all along, sphere and cylinder and nothing else. I thought that invoking the plane could be useful. But it can also be confusing.
So if you transform from a plane to the sphere, the states will be.
You might have to put a state at infinity.
Okay.
Corresponding to whatever boundary conditions you had put in your calculation on the plane. So if you're, right. Okay, so back here. The first thing we should do is do the wild transformation to make this into a sphere. That's the most straightforward way to do a calculation. So essentially, each of these infinite tubes gets capped off, and you get a sphere with three insertions. Okay. Let's say that the insertions are at Z1 bar, and Z1, Z2, and Z3. So let's do this calculation. What are we inserting at Z1, Z2, and Z3? We're inserting the operator corresponding to these states. We know what P1 is e to the I P1 x. What is G? Is C1, C1 bar. So we obtain the correlation, the scattering amplitude of three tachyons at the tree level is being related to a correlation function on the sphere of C1, C1 bar, e to the I, P1x, C2, C2 bar, e to the I, P2x, C3, C3 bar, e to the I, P3x. We have already collected all the ingredients to this calculation. What do we get? Now, let's use a bit of kinematics. We have a delta function of momentum conservation, which I keep forgetting to write down. And these are tachyons. So on shell, it should be the case that pi squared is 2. But that implies that p1 plus p2 squared must be equal to p3 squared, which means that p2 p1 dot p2 should be minus 2 on shell. So once I impose my on shell condition, this is just 1. So see, the choice of where these points were was really a gauge choice, because there is a diffeomorphism that allows me to move them wherever I want. My answer better be gauge independent. It's gauge independent if and only if the states I'm inserting are BST closed, and in particular on shell. That's why exactly when I put things on shell, the dependence on Z1, Z2, Z3 drops out. Any questions?
Mm-hmm. Before you specialize the p1 squared is equal to 2, and if you just write down this expression, is there anything special to the tachyons in this expression? Or let's say if you had any other thing, what would change over here?
That's my next calculation. So what changes is that I put a different matrix state, and so I need a different operator. So we'll do the calculation with a different operator, and let's see what happens. But here, so we learned something about the tachyon in bosonic string theory. The tachyon has a self-interaction of intensity 1. I'm not discussing it now, but there is an overall coupling, string coupling, that you put in front of all interactions. So this can say that this is exactly equal to the string coupling. So I think I can perhaps colonize the blackboard up there. Maybe I'll just, this is already the bottom blackboard. Okay, not ideal. Now, what's the next thing I can do? Let's try to see the emission of a graviton from a tachyon. So I'm going to take my strings, the incoming string state, to be just the momentum mode. One of the outgoing string states, again, is just a pure momentum ground state. But here I'm going to put a generic massless state. Could be a graviton, could be a dilaton, could be a B field. Sorry, I'm already writing the operator. I meant epsilon mu nu, a minus 1 mu, a minus 1 bar nu, acting on a momentum 3, p3, times the ground state. OK. So this corresponds to the operator, epsilon mu nu, del x mu, del bar x nu, e to the I, p3 x normal ordered. So now I need a correlation function for the scalar fields, which is a bit more complicated than what I had before. I need e to the ip1 x, e to the ip2 x, and then dx del bar x, e to the ip3 x. But it's done exactly in the same way by weak contractions. So all that happens is that this guy will get we contracted with some of the guys inside here. And this guy will get recontracted with some of the guys in this exponent. There are no weak contractions inside the normal order. So the answer looks like P1 over Z1 minus Z3 plus P2 over Z2 minus Z3, which is what comes out of recontracting this with that or that. And then I get P1 over Z1 bar minus Z3 bar, P2 over Z2 bar minus Z3 bar, and then the usual Z1 minus Z2 to the 2 P1 P2, etc. So let's apply this formula here, putting back all the indices and everything else, and including the contributor function from the ghosts. Okay, first sight, it looks like a bit of a tragic expression. It's a big complicated function of Z1, Z2, and Z3. But that's okay. As long if we don't impose on shell conditions, this is not supposed to be gauge invariant. Now, what are the conditions we need to impose? There's some kinematics, and there's some transversality. So transversality requires epsilon to be perpendicular to P3. But my momentum conservation, this implies that epsilon contracted with P1 is minus epsilon contracted with P2. I can use that to simplify this expression. Then I do this subtraction, I get Z2 minus Z1 over Z1 minus Z3, Z2 minus Z3, absolute value square, and of course it cancels these extra factors. And I just end up with a final answer, which is pretty reasonable. All the gauge dependence is gone. And this is a pretty reasonable Feynman vertex for a scalar particle interacting with a graviton. Now, this is proportional to the second power of the momentum of the particles going through. These powers of the momenta are ultimately the reason for which theories of gravity are going to give you trouble. Yes?
Is that
P1 U, P1 U, or P1 U, P2? P1, P1. Because contracting P1 with epsilon is the same as contracting P2. Second, if you remember QED, the interaction vertex between a scalar QED, between a scalar and a photon is P1, which is the same as P2. When contracted with the polarization. Okay, so Now, you might think that this was still a pretty complicated calculation with this weak contraction of free bosons. Yes?
If you have scattering of a tachyon and a graviton, what determines the initial and final state of the host?
Oh, we decided to have, so these are supposed to be on shell, Q, so they're supposed to be Q closed modulo Q exact states. And I'm invoking the theorem that all the Q closed states are of this form. Something times the ground, ghost ground state. So now you might think, right, you might think these calculations are complicated. I invite you to compute the vertex between three gravitons, okay, with this method. Might look a bit complicated, but if you then move on and say, okay, let me compute a scattering amplitude between 16 gravitons. If you do it like this, you might have a lot of terms. If we do the Feynman diagrams, it will be much, much worse. So these sort of calculations are the first hint that Feynman diagrams are a very poor way to do calculations in gauge theory and in gravity. Because it turned out to be almost easier to do things in string theory and then specialize to gravity. Now, of course, when you do it in string theory with many particles, then you're going to get all sorts of stuff propagating intermediate legs, and you need to try to figure out what was gravitons. But what I'm trying to say is that starting from these, and it took several years, many, many years, but people started realizing that there are better ways to do gauge theory or gravity at the level of perturbation theory. So now there is a whole cottage industry of developing techniques to compute Feynman to compute scattering amplitudes of gauge theory or gravitons without Feynman diagrams, which fits in all the way to LHC calculations. OK. Any questions?
Can we compare the fluid bond string amplitude with the diagram amplitude we calculate using your theory by taking the limit of the string amplitude?
Well, there are various ways. Part of the trick is to just send the mass of the massive, so that the string, the parameter tells you how massive are the massive strings. You can sort of transcend that to infinity, so you can trigger the massive string. Now, you still have both graviton, dilaton, and B field in the calculation, so you might not be still terribly happy. With open strings, it's better because you get. But still, there are people have worked out ways to extract gravity amplitudes. Ultimately, people don't use string theory to get their examples. I'm just saying that they started using some methods which are inspired by this, and then it just went off in a variety of directions.
In general, will we also have an integral over the moduli space, and do we not have it here because it's a sphere? Or?
Well, even if the next lecture will be four-point functions, okay, choose tachyons going through tachyons, in that case, you start having moduli space. Oh. See, if your sphere has four points, you can play around the position of three of them using this contrast transformations, but the fourth one will be non-trivial. You can see also from looking at the Gauss number, if I want four string states, I'm going to have four C's. If I have four C's, I better have a B. And the B comes from the measure insertion.